in fact, let me go further than that, Don. I'm the first Arkansas governor in over 50 years whose own children actually attended exclusively public schools of my own state. A lot of Democrats before me talked about their love of public education but put their own kids in private schools. Hmm. That, to me, is the hypocrisy. My kids graduated from public schools, as did I, and as did my wife. I think that the point is that I'm a big believer in a good, solid public education. I want it to be efficient for the taxpayers. I don't believe government is always wrong. I think that the true conservative position is that government should be effective. It ought to be practical. It ought to be competent. It shouldn't be non-existent. And there are some conservatives who really are not Republicans, they're libertarians. And the Republican Party has been infiltrated by many people who really are not true Republicans in the classic sense. They are libertarians. They believe in virtually no government. And that's not a Republican position, nor is it a true conservative position.
That's interesting, because you're sounding like somewhere between Barry Goldwater's last 10 years and perhaps Nelson Rockefeller in that regard. And that
please,
again,
don't tell anyone that.
That throws you into the unelectable category.
Conservative, Tom. I think that that's the true conservative movement, that we think taxes should not be higher than are necessary, but we do think we ought to have decent roads. We think that there ought to be good schools. We think that there ought to be fire trucks when you dial 911. That requires some revenue. So I'm not one of these that think that that the point of government is to disappear. I think we should take care of the environment. That's, to me, a Christian position as a steward of something God created. There are a number of positions, but again, I think sometimes people, if they hear that I'm a conservative and I'm a Christian, they automatically assume they know what I believe and what I stand for. I think there's going to be some surprises when people read this book to find out that true conservatism does have a compassion and a concern for the environment, does believe that we ought to look for alternative energy sources. One of the things that will surprise people in my book, at least it has so far, is in the chapter on education, I make a strong case for music and art for every school student, and it's something I let our own state here in Arkansas to do, where every student has music and art education by a certified teacher. Mm-hmm. And that's something I'm very passionate about, because the future economy is going to be a creative economy. If you cut music and art programs out of the curriculum, you essentially are destroying the very capability of a child to develop his or her creativity.
This is fascinating. It's just to your point that the libertarians have taken over the Republican Party, I think, is very well taken. Although, you know, I kind of flip it around. I say libertarians are Republicans who want to smoke dope and get laid. You know, it's point well taken. Mike Huckabee, we're going to have to wrap this up, but I thank you for being with us. Mike Huckabee, the governor of Arkansas, the 2008 possible presidential candidate, the author of From Hope to Higher Ground, two websites here, Mike Huckabee President, 2008.blogspot.com, or Hope for America PAC, PAC.org. Governor Huckabee, thank you for being with us today.
Thanks, Tom. Enjoyed the visit.
Good talking with you. 16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, the pill that will help you escape the matrix.
A true revolution of values will lay hands on the world order and say of war, this way of settling differences is not just. This business of burning human beings with napalm, filling our nation's homes and with orphans and widows, of injecting poisonous drugs of hate into the veins of peoples normally humane, of sending men home from dark and bloody battlefields, physically handicapped and psychologically deranged, and not be reconciled with wisdom, justice, and love.
And welcome back. Martin Luther King Day here, all across the United States. Tom Hartman here with you. Truth in Broadcasting for a Change. My apologies to our affiliates and listeners in the first few minutes of our program. Apparently, dead air was coming out of New York, and we're not sure why, and we've got engineers trying to track it down, but it looks like everything's under control at the moment. Has Bush ordered a secret war on Iran? That's an interesting question, the question du jour. I think it's a particularly interesting question. And Scott Pelley on CBS here on 60 Minutes interviewing George W. Bush. First of all, Bush, you know, all of his body language was, why am I here? I just want to get out of here. And then Scott Pelley says, and I quote, the Democrat leadership. Now, keep in mind, referring to the Democratic Party as the Democrat Party is, you know, an old trick that goes back, quite a ways, but it's been resurrected in recent times as a way of dissing Democrats, as, you know, especially with the emphasis on the word rat, right? And because Democratic, they found with focus groups and whatnot, it makes people feel warm and fuzzy. Democrat sounds more like a politician. And so the Republicans, I mean, we're not calling them the Repub Party or something like that, but the Repubes or the Republican Party have started calling the Democratic Party the Democrat Party. And there ain't no such thing. And so here we have Scott Pelley, who is supposed to be a journalist. He works for CBS. This is a guy who's pulling probably at least a good solid mid-six-figure salary, working for CBS. Big deal. Scott Pelley being a shill for the, either he's a shill for the Republicans, and this is the and the guy should be immediately fired and hired by Fox News, or he's one of the most pathetic examples of a journalist ever out there. Because here he is talking to the President of the United States on 60 Minutes, and it is a major interview that much of America is watching, and he says, and I quote, the Democrat leadership says, we want to support the troops who are on the ground. We just want to redline the extra 20,000. Yeah, right. Democrat? So Bush says, yeah, I know. I will resist that. Listen, we got people criticizing this plan before it's had a chance to work. They're saying we're not even going to fund this thing, and they're not going to give it a chance. So Pelley follows up. He says, there's no Democrat plan. Right? Well, I'm sorry, there is. There has been for a good long time. Go back, you know, Joe Biden put forward a plan. I mean, what was Jack Murtha talking about a year and a half ago about redeployment? And this is the kind of thing that, this is the tragedy of modern media. It's just the absolute tragedy of modern media. And you know, a real freaking horror show. And on top of that, then you've got George W. Bush saying, well, you know, do I have to go do just because Congress says something, just because the American people say something? Should I be held accountable? Don't think so. You know, and you know, the weirdness of that.
If you have the authority to put the troops in there no matter what the Congress wants to do.
I think I've got, in this situation, I do, yeah. Now, I fully understand they could try to stop me from doing it. But I've made my decision, and we're going forward.
Yeah, good luck. Good luck. Try and stop me. Go ahead. Try and stop me. I dare you. And Dick Cheney, everything going fine? Your boss says that there have been mistakes made, that it's not going so well. Dick Cheney?
Well, I think if you look at what's transpired in Iraq, Chris, we have, in fact, made enormous progress.
Oh, we've made enormous progress. We've killed 650,000 people. It's just marvelous. We've got electricity up to 2 hours and 15 minutes a day. We've got the Shia against us. We've got the Sunni against us. We've got the Kurds against us. We've got Iran against us. We've got Saudi Arabia threatening us. We've made marvelous progress. Yes, it's a great day if you're trying to bring about the rapture. I mean, I can't. There's what other possible reality could there be? I want to share with you, by the way, William McAllister wrote a brilliant piece. An absolutely brilliant piece from firstmonday.org, the peer-reviewed journal on the Internet. It's called The Iraq Insurgency, Anatomy of a Tribal Rebellion. And it's going to take just a couple minutes to share it with you. I'll do it after the break at the bottom of the hour. But his perspective is one that I think that we all need to understand, particularly on this Martin Luther King Day when we should be thinking about peace. You know, what brings about peace? What's possible for peace? Martin Luther King, one of the most eloquent spokesmen for peace certainly in the 20th century. At the same time, over at MSNBC Newsweek, January 26th, has George W. Bush ordered up a secret war against Iran and Syria? This is going to be in the next issue of Newsweek. It's out on the web, but it's not out in print yet. Some administration opponents in Capitol Hill began asking the question after U.S. forces in recent weeks arrested two groups of Iranian government representatives inside Iraq. basically the bottom line here in this article, four different authors working on it, is that Bush has already begun the war against Iran. And of course, Scott Ritter came on this program, 6 months ago and said, oh, yeah, we're already doing special operations in there. Plus, we're supporting MEC, a terrorist group. 27 minutes past. Welcome back. 33 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Listener-supported radio, a program supported by you, our listeners, supporting our sponsors. Listen to your local affiliates for the local sponsors and patronize them. And when you do, be sure and tell them you heard it on the program. And also our national sponsors as well. Sacred Grounds Coffee, for example, saving the planet one cup at a time. SacredGroundsCoffee.com, their website, 1-800-425-2532, their number. Small Dog Electronics, get the latest iPods now at smalldog.com or 1-800-511-MAX. And the organic wine company, ecowine.com, 1-888-ECO-WINE. It's 34 minutes past the hour. Our telephone number, 1-866-440-8466. 440-THOM, our telephone number, toll free all across the United States of America. Gabriel in Seattle, Washington on the line. Hey, Gabriel.
Hi.
Good morning. I understand you are 8 years old.
Yes.
Well, thank you for calling.
You're welcome. And I was just wanting to talk about Martin Luther King's Day.
Mm-hmm.
And I was writing a little poem about it.
Okay.
And I'll tell you, okay?
Sure.
And it's for the marches he organized from Alabama to Washington, D.C. to peacefully protest segregation and on schools and on buses.
Mm-hmm. That's great.
Thank you.
That's very good. Gabriel, thank you very much for calling and sharing that with us.
You're welcome.
Great to hear from you. Thank you very much. Jane in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Jane. Oh, Jane, you've got your radio on here. You've got to turn off your radio. Let me just play for you a clip of Martin Luther King on the 4th of April, 1967, talking about the real issues here. Because Gabriel's point that Martin Luther King was protesting segregation is true. But it was only one piece of what his work was. He was, in fact, he was at the sanitation workers' strike, speaking at a sanitation workers' strike in Memphis when he was assassinated. He was a very, very strong friend of labor, and he was also very opposed to the Vietnam War. Martin Luther King.
When machines and computers, profit motives and property rights are considered more important than people, the giant triplets of racism, extreme materialism, and militarism are incapable of being conquered.
You get that? When property rights are more important than people? I mean, this is the core of the libertarian/conservative/republican philosophy. And then he talks about how the confluence of war and racism. I wonder if the oil... Well, you know, there's plenty of oil off the coast of Norway. We don't seem to be bombing any light-skinned Norwegians. There were a lot of communists all around the country, all around the world in the 1960s, but it was in Vietnam, Asian people that we decided to take that war to. He so clearly points this out. He continues.
A true revolution of values.
The marvelous word that the Republicans tried to hijack, unsuccessfully in my opinion,
will soon cause us to question the fairness and justice of many of our past and present policies. On the one hand, we are called to play the Good Samaritan on life's roadside, but that will be only an initial act.
The Good Samaritan, of course, who helped out the man who had been beaten and robbed on the road to Samaria. But he was just one man helping out one man. Again, Martin Luther King was talking about, let's change the entire system.
One day we must come to see that the whole Jericho Road must be transformed so that men and women will not be constantly beaten and robbed as they make their journey on life's highway. True compassion is more than flinging a coin to a beggar. It comes to see that an edifice which produces beggars needs restructuring.
An edifice which produces beggars. And, you know, speaking of many of the very real problems that we're facing in the United States and around the world as a result of the way that we've been doing things. I want to just, before I get back to your calls and, you know, some of the other things we're going to talk about today, basically we have 3 hours for this. I want to share with you some of the highlights of this article I mentioned by William McAllister on the Iraq insurgency. This is a guy who's an expert on military issues and tribalism. And this is an absolutely brilliant piece. I flew to Oregon City this week, to Nevada City on Friday night, and down to Sacramento, and then drove over there and spoke Friday night in Nevada City. And I read this thing on the I read it three times. I mean, I reread this article. It was so brilliant. William McAllister, retired military officer. Currently employed in Iraq by Floor Amac LLC, a private construction company. I mean, he's got it. He's nailed this thing down. He says, instead of thinking about Iraq as a country, or for that matter, the Middle East, we need to be thinking in terms of tribes and clans. He says, the tribe is the largest unit whose associated clan claims a common lineage or descent. Okay. But actually, membership in a tribe isn't necessarily genealogical. People will change tribal affiliation simply by saying, I'm no longer a member of that tribe, I'm now a member of this tribe. I mean, it can be partly a political act. Much of tribal genealogy, if it exists at all, is often based on fictive kinship ties. In claiming a particular ancestry, individuals may align themselves with a given political position. Tribes exist in a perpetual state of flux. Tribal identity is flexible. He says the clan is the second level of organization in Iraq and derives its unity of purpose from its sheikh, his family lineage, and the territorial proximity of the various sub-clan affiliates. Now, these sub-clans are all patrilineal groups. They're basically extended families. And these are composed of kinship groups, and those are divided into households. You get it? There's a whole organizational structure here. He says the tribe and the clan perform primarily political and military functions, and the subclans and households primarily economic ones. Weaker tribes seek security through alliances with larger, stronger tribes. So if tribe A has traditionally been an enemy of tribe B, but tribe C is now threatening both tribe A and B will combine to fight tribe C. Tribe D may join with tribe C. So now these two tribes form, a larger tribe, as it were. Anyhow, he says a group of extended families eventually. Now, this is how Saddam Hussein came to power. A group of extended families gains control over a subclan. The subclan exploits existing social, economic, and military networks and widens its dominance through the negotiation of alliances and patronage with other key clans and tribes to win a preeminent position in a newer or pre-existing tribal confederation. Once the tribal confederation has amassed enough influence, it challenges the state to gain power. The primary clan literally becomes the state. This is why the Sunnis in El Anbar, in Tikrit, in the place where Saddam Hussein came from, why they're so upset. It's not just, hey, he was one of our guys. It was, he was the leader of our clan, of our tribe, of both. In fact, William McAllister writes, Saddam Hussein's state reflected this mixture of traditional and modernizing autocracy. He says the social dynamic that sustains the ongoing fighting in Iraq, especially in the Al Anbar province, is best understood in tribal terms. And he said there's a really simple rule here that has to do with all this stuff. He said this rule is very simple. There is nothing immoral about killing an individual so long as he is not a kinsman or an ally. An individual belonging to a clan or tribe is protected since his death would incur the enmity of the extended family. In other words, if you're a member of a tribe, you're safe because if somebody from some other tribe kills you, then your tribe has an obligation to kill one person from that other tribe. And it always works out that way. However, if somebody from another tribe kills, say somebody from tribe A kills somebody from tribe B, somebody from tribe B then is entitled to have reprisal and come back and kill one person in tribe A. And at that point, everybody dusts their hands and says, okay, it's even. No prosecution, no crime, no courts, nothing. Hey, it's even now. But if tribe A kills one person in tribe B, somebody from tribe A kills somebody in tribe B, and tribe B responds by killing 10 people in tribe A, that's considered disproportionate. And if it is massively disproportionate, it can create what's called a blood feud that can last over generations, sometimes over centuries. Now, the main tactics that are used by the tribal fighters are the raid and the ambush, surprise, shock, and rapid withdrawal. And what he suggests in this article, he talks about how when we went into Fallujah, basically they viewed us as another tribe coming in. We fired into a group of them and killed 70 people. They then killed four, remember the four contractors? They thought, this is an appropriate response. All should be well. So then we went in and leveled their city. And there's no way we're ever going to end the blood feud that we started with that. 45 minutes past the hour.
And I won't back down. Well, I know what's right. I got just one life.
And welcome back. 10 minutes before the hour. Coming up on 9 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Fair and slightly unbalanced, but maybe that's the way it should be. Jane in Seattle, you wanted to plug an MLK parade and protest in Seattle. Let me put you on the air.
Yeah, I wanted. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hi, I haven't talked to you for quite a while, but I wanted to make a couple comments. First, keep up the good work.
You're
doing a wonderful job, and I appreciate it. Also, I invite you to come to Seattle anytime you want to, sir.
Thank you.
And the other thing I want to do is respectfully ask all my fellow citizens in Seattle and Tacoma region to please come on out and support the values of peace and equality by coming out to the Martin Luther King events today.
And those
I'm going in a few minutes with my two grandkids.
And I'm assuming the local paper has publicized where and when they all.
Yes, it does. It's all there. I just want to give them a shout out and say, come on out, people.
There you go. Okay. Thank you very much, Jane. Good to hear from you. Thank you. I'm sorry. Happy MLK Day to you as well. Tom in Brattleboro, Vermont. Hey, Tom.
Hello, Tom. How are you doing?
I'm just great, but I'll get better. What's up?
Well, I had your radio show on. And I was only half listening, and I heard you talking about the tribes and clans and stuff like that in the Arab society. And I've lived over there, and you're right on the money, and I'd like to find out what your source was, because I'd like to check it out a little bit more.
This is an article. It's over at firstmonday.org is the website. And it's
First Monday.
Firstmonday.org, and it's by William S. McAllister. It's called The Iraq Insurgency, Anatomy of a Tribal Rebellion. And here's just to take it one step further. In the case of Fallujah, he says, 7 close-knit tribes comprise the inhabitants of the city and the surrounding area. He says the presence of an invader, that's us, proved the catalyst to provoke the tribal social network. Unresolved disputes between the Coalition Provisional Authority and local leaders and local dismay over the continuous skirmishes between coalition and tribal fighters heightened local tensions to the breaking point. Once the breaking point was reached, they actually convened a council. It was called the Mujahideen Shura, a council of holy warriors and representing resistance forces, local dignitaries, and tribal sheikhs. Basically, all the elders of all the families, the clans got together, these seven tribes, and formed a plan to guide the direction of the insurrection. And basically, they saw this as simply, we have to restore balance. You know, this may seem like a very primitive, form of social organization. It's actually very sophisticated, and it has survived thousands and thousands of years. He goes on to say that in this article that in a way this almost acts like the social connection. They pre-exist, you know, these social connections. He says freedom of action for insurgents is assured as disparate sections of the social network are activated like a contagious disease. You know, they just kind of spreads. And then he talks about how the tribal system ensures a reasonable balance of power. When a strong central government is lacking and unable to project authority, vendetta imparts a credible deterrent capability into the balance of power equation. And, you know, and like I said, he talks about how in Fallujah we really blew it, but with this hugely disproportionate response, and the result is a permanent blood feud.
Well, I think he's right on the money.
Yeah, he is. And tragically, Americans, A, don't understand this, and B, obviously Bush doesn't have a clue about this, nor do any of his advisors. They all think that we're fighting, A, a nation state, and B, people who are terrorists, and C, people who are bad guys, and it's none of the above. We're fighting individual clans and individual tribes who, if we weren't there, many cases would be fighting each other.
They'd be fighting each other, of course.
Yeah, not necessarily on a firefight day-to-day basis, but, you know, when something's out of balance, the balance gets restored. And when it becomes large or regional, and they, you know, convene a convocation and figure out how to organize it. And we've just totally screwed up this entire social system. And so they're trying to restore balance to it, and we're just continuing to mess it up. Tom, thanks a lot for the call. Good to hear from you. I appreciate it. Jim in Grand Rapids, Michigan, listening to WTKG. Hey, Jim.
Hi, Tim. Hey, I just want to make one more comment on that McAllister article, because it's exactly right. What we're dealing with in Iraq and in Afghanistan, too, for that matter, what we're dealing with is a 12th century society with automatic weapons.
Yeah, well said. I actually, right after 9/11, I mean, literally a week after 9/11, there was one of these instant books that came out from Rodale Press called From the Ashes, A Spiritual Response to 9/11. And they asked, as I recall, it was 27 different people to write a piece for it. And the Pope submitted a piece, and the Dalai Lama put in a piece, and Billy Graham wrote a piece, and Neil Donald Walsh wrote a piece, and Marianne Williamson, and I wrote a piece for it. And it's in the book. And in it, I made the point that Christianity went through, you know, Christianity was very much like Osama bin Laden, you know, in that way, in the 11th century with the Crusades. I mean, you know, it was a violent and bloody religion.
They were awful.
And Christianity went through, as a result of the Reformation and then later the Enlightenment, went through a radical transformation into a modern religion. And Judaism went through it arguably long before Christianity did, I'd say in large part as a result of the oppression of the Roman Empire. But Islam, much of modern Islam has gone through it, but a good chunk of modern Islam has not. And oddly, there are parts of Christianity that are kind of going backwards too right now. But I think you're absolutely right. What we're dealing with are time periods as much as anything else.
We can't possibly understand them, and they can't possibly understand us.
All right. And we think that if we just bomb them enough, we'll scare them enough.
Yeah.
And really, frankly, I don't even think that anymore that George Bush believes this. I think what he's trying to do is have his decent interval. You'll recall Henry Kissinger. Jim, I got to drop the call, but thanks for the call. Henry Kissinger went over to Vietnam, and in 1974, the election was coming. And McGovern, you know, hey, peace, peace. And Nixon had to say, you know, we're gonna end this thing. Kissinger goes over and says, we will leave Vietnam. We just need a decent interval. In other words, he wanted to dump it on the next president. Turned out to be Gerry Ford, but nonetheless, said, we just need to dump it on somebody else. Kissinger is now advising Bush. And I am convinced that Bush knows that we are, you know, we've totally blown this thing. And he just wants to make sure that he's not the president that goes down with it, that it's another president who gets the, quote, blame, end quote, for having to leave Iraq. And so we're just looking for a decent interval. 56 minutes past the hour. Bob Borsage.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back to the Ready Support Group, up by and for We the People of the United States of America. Bob Borisov is with us. He's the co-director of the Campaign for America's Future, the website ourfuture.org. Hey, Bob, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom, how are you?
I'm great, but I'll get better. Great to have you with us.
It's a pleasure.
You recently wrote that the conservative era is over. I wonder if maybe you're being a bit too optimistic.
Well, it may be optimism, but it certainly is bankrupt ideologically. It is devoid of ideas that can deal with the problems we face. And more interestingly, I think you see a Democratic majority in the House that, with its first 100 hours program and its challenge to the president of Iraq, is beginning to point the way to a different direction.
Well, you know, Rush Limbaugh is fond of pointing out,
Roosevelt is dead. His policies may live on, but we're in the process of doing something about that as well.
And they are still bankrupting this nation so that they'll have an excuse to do away with social spending. They're still, you know, the Republican Party still as corrupt as they ever were. I mean, it's just, do you really think that we've reached that point that Kevin Phillips described back in, as I recall, 1967 when he wrote the emerging Republican majority? Have we reached a point where an emerging Democratic majority is real, that this is really the end of a 26-year era and the beginning of a new era, and that it might be more than just a Democratic era but actually a progressive era?
Well, I think that's the possibility. I think the conservative era, in fact, is over. You can't keep going down the road we've been going down. The question is what comes next, and that is not well defined. Needless to say, the Democratic Party is not a progressive party, a reform party yet. There's a lot of people need to get a better view of what they ought to be doing. And needless to say, the corporate lobbies are mobilizing and are still very powerful in this country. And so we've got a long way to go. But I think you've seen with this election and with Bush's debacles at home and abroad, you've seen the country starting to understand that they can't continue going down the road we've been on.
Yeah. It's you're so right about the Democratic Party. I very, very rarely have politicians on this program, other than Bernie Sanders. With Bernie, there's no ground rules. You know, he'll take any call. All we do is take calls from listeners. No, he'll take any call from anybody on any topic. And you know, whether you like it or not, he'll tell you what he thinks.
Yeah, he's terrific. But, you know, what's interesting to me, this election, you got Sherrod Brown in the Senate. You got Tester. You've got Jim Webb. These guys have different politics, but they all have a populist temper.
Mm-hmm.
And they all are prepared to, I think, to handle, to take on some of the big corporate interests in the country and to try to wrestle with where we go in the future. And so there's a great deal more promise in the Democratic caucus than there used to be in the Senate.
I agree. And at the same time, one of the reasons why I go out of my way not to put big-name politicians on this program, because we do get solicited all the time for this, is that there's usually don't talk to me about this list, you know.
Right.
There's that, or you know that if you go there, you know, if I asked, you know, if I try to pin Debbie Stabenow to the wall about why did she vote for the bankruptcy bill, you know, I'll be toast with her and with Washington and everything, you know. And it's just like, there's just virtually all of these politicians have these do not go there areas, and I won't put up with it. It's like, I'm sorry, this is not suck up to politician radio here.
Right, and I think we got to challenge them and we got to hold them accountable, we're going to certainly have to do that over the next month.
Well, and the way to do it is not to have talk show hosts be nice to them. I think it's by having the people. You know, we the people, all of our listeners, the people contacting them and saying, hey, wait a minute, we're mad as hell and we're not going to take it anymore. This is where we're at. Where we're at, you know, people may call it left and they may call it progressive, but it's where the majority of America is at right now. And on a whole variety of issues, from the environment to labor to national health care, I mean, Ted Kennedy, I thought the most underreported story of last week was Ted Kennedy coming out and calling for Medicare for all.
Absolutely. And the public is way ahead of him. I think you're going to see a debate in 08 that inevitably politicians are going to be called on by voters to tell them what they're going to do about a broken health care system.
Yeah. Now, at the same time, in the you say the conservative era is over. At the same time, in the Republican Party, I had Mike Huckabee on a few minutes ago, an hour ago, actually. And there is a battle inside the Republican Party over what it means to be Republican. I mean, he made the comment. He said, I think the Republican Party's been taken over by libertarians. And I said, oh,
would that it were.
Yeah, I mean, you know, libertarians in my mind are Republicans who want to smoke dope and get laid. You know, but they're equally into this weird conservative economic ideology and you know, the idea of an economic meritocracy.
Yeah, yeah, you know, the each strain of conservatism which has gone into building their majority over the last quarter century, I think, is now discredited. So you know, the social conservatives veered off into this extreme right doctrinal fundamentalism that wants to take on stem cell research and be in Terry Schiavo's hospital room. The neocon foreign policy militarist types have taken us into Iraq and the worst foreign policy debacle in our history. The free market people have us with a trade policy that now runs up $1 trillion, you know, $800 billion worth of debt. We have to borrow more than $2 billion a day from China and Japan and other countries in order to pay for our trading debt while crippling American manufacturing. All of these strains, I think, have played themselves out. We now see the results. And so it doesn't matter which conservatism you're talking about, all of it's bankrupt.
Yeah, we're talking with Bob Borsaj. He's the co-director of the Campaign for America's Future, ourfuture.org, the website. Bob, there's an old saying about rats. It's probably true of most mammals, including humans, that when they're cornered and frightened, they're far more dangerous than under any other circumstances. Would it be a stretch to suggest that, particularly if some of the low-level folks start being investigated, prosecuted, and rolling over, you know, and it starts working its way up like it did with the plumbers and the Watergate burglars eventually to the president, that Bush and Cheney have been claiming so much power for themselves that we should be concerned about what they might do?
Well, Bush has got two more years. In that 2 years, we're going to have a what I think is going to be a vicious and difficult fight about Iraq. Not just how do we get out of Iraq, but the fight over who lost Iraq, with the president and McCain and others really positioning themselves to be able to say, you know, Democrats lost this war. If they hadn't stabbed us in the back, we could have won in Iraq. And I think we're headed into a very difficult politics around that that will really be a president intent on sustaining a course against the opinion of his generals, of his people, and of the Congress. And so it's going to be a very ugly, difficult problem.
How did the Democrats combat that? I mean, this is the exact same thing that Nixon did, Kissinger's, you know, decent interval strategy of, you know, just, you know, yes, we'll hand Vietnam back to you, don't worry. We just want the next president to be the one who gets stuck with the blame for it, not us. You know, we're going to do a surge, the Christmas bombing, but, you know, don't worry, pretty soon we're going to be out of there. That kind of thing. I mean, Kissinger played this game before. He played it very well. And the result was that, with the exception of Bill Clinton, ever since Vietnam, Republicans and Jimmy Carter, Republicans have been in the White House. I mean, there's been this enormous amount of Republican rule as a consequence of this mythology that somehow the Democratic Congress cutting off the funding for Vietnam caused us to, quote, lose Vietnam. If the same thing happens in Iraq, how do the Democrats deal with that?
Well, I think it's a big problem, and there's no question that Democrats and progressives have to be concerned about it. There's some differences. I think that the difference in Vietnam now is that the officer class in Vietnam felt betrayed both by their troops and by the American people, whereas the officer class here, for the most part, thinks the president has gone off the deep end.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's more support among military circles for getting out than there might have been in Vietnam. But
right,
a lot of education of the public. I think Democrats have to hold very aggressive hearings on how we got in, on how it was waged, on the staggering ways that Rumsfeld drove us into a war without a plan or a clue about what we were going to do. And then about the sacrifices that Americans have made over there, you know, the best troops in the world misled by their leaders. And it's got to be they've got to drag these people out. We've got to challenge the presidential powers. But it's difficult. There's no country likes to lose a war, particularly this one, which knows that it has the most powerful military in the world and can't figure out
how to use it. Bob, we just have about 10 seconds left. Anything hot happening for ourfuture.org, the campaign for America's future?
Well, we've been pushing the 100 hours agenda. We want progressives to spend at least a second understanding that Democrats have raised the minimum wage. They're about to cut interest on student loans. They're doing stem cell research. They're going to revoke oil subsidies. They're doing some good things in this first a few hours of the Congress, and it's worth applauding them for it.
We need to focus some attention on it. Well done. Bob Borisov, he's with the Campaign for America's Future, ourfuture.org, the website. Bob, thanks for being with us today.
My pleasure. Take
good
care.
Talking with you. 16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, the place for being progressive. Never felt so good.
God has a way of standing before the nations with judgment, and it seems that I can hear God saying to America, you're too arrogant. You don't change your ways. I will rise up and break the backbone of your power, and I'll place it in the hands of a nation that doesn't even know my name. I call on Washington today. I call on every man and woman of goodwill all over America today. I call on the young men of America who must make a choice today. Take a stand on this issue. Tomorrow may be too late. The book may close. And I don't know about you, I ain't gonna study war no more.
And welcome back to Truth and Common Sense in Broadcasting. Tom Hartman here with you on Martin Luther King Day. Let's take a look from the words of the man who would study war no more to the war from the man who seems in love with it, George W. Bush, the ongoing occupation of Iraq.
I want to know who the men in the shadows are. I want to hear somebody asking them why. They can be counted on to tell us who our enemies are. But they're never the ones to fight and to die. And there are lives in the balance.
Following our security developments in Iraq as of 10:20 GMT on Monday, this compiled by Reuters, Dateline Baqaba, the bodies of 11 people were found shot in the head, bound and gagged in that city north of Baghdad, according to police. Nine of the victims were found in the west of the town and the other two in the city center. In Baghdad, a roadside bomb targeting a police patrol killed three policemen and wounded two others in Rustamiya in southeastern Baghdad. In Kirkuk, a Katusha rocket landed in a house, wounding two people, 250 miles north of Baghdad. In Baghdad, a bomb planted under a car wounded two people in El Nidhal Street in central Baghdad. In Iskandaria, gunmen opened fire at shops, wounding one person in that town. In other development, two of Saddam Hussein's aides were hanged before dawn on Monday, the Iraqi government said, admitting that the head of his half-brother, Barzan Ibrahim al-Takriti, was also ripped from his body during the execution. We are such compassionate conservatives, right? 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. If you'd like to drop into our live chat room, tomhartman.com, however you spell it should get you there, and just click live chat right up at the top in the center of the page there, and it'll drop you into the chat room. Gary in Cheyenne, Wyoming, listening on Sirius. Hey, Gary, what's up?
Tom, I'd like to recommend your discussion a little bit ago about the tribes and also what you said last week about how that interfaced with the history of our country back in the 1900s and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
I'll tell you what, if you anytime you want to redo that session or whatever, it was excellent. Helping understand how this stuff evolves, it's the most clear and concise and rational, reasonable reason why we have the problems we have. If people only would realize the link between poverty and doing without and crime.
Yeah. Well, and in fact, when you look at it, the tribal system and the retribution-based honor societies are a way of surviving in an era or a place of scarcity. It's a way of dealing with poverty. It's a very functional way of dealing with poverty. We have the exact same thing in the United States. It's called the Crips and the Bloods, right? And it's called gangs. It's the exact same thing. It's a tribal system. And it is a system that these highly advanced primates called humans have evolved to deal with poverty. But when you do away with the poverty, when you provide a middle class, then people can move up the, you know, Maslow's hierarchy of human needs, as it were. They can kind of move up the psychological ladder, the emotional ladder, the whatever you want to call it ladder. It's not, I wouldn't say evolutionary because it's entirely in our heads. It move up the ladder a little bit and start concerning themselves with higher needs like the social needs and the intellectual needs and curiosity and creativity and things like that, and set aside the tribal differences. In our country, the tribal differences have historically, even among the working poor, I mean, setting aside the very poor that join the gangs, the working poor have been the ethnic differences. You know, it was the Poles against the Swedes, against the Italians, against the Irish back in the 19th century, as you know, poor groups and everybody, you know, against the blacks, and as poor groups were pitted one against the other. And to the extent that you can bring about a middle class, I mean, this is how Saddam Hussein was actually, at a certain level, very slowly detribalizing Iraq and was able to hold Iraq together, was by creating a middle class up until the War of 91 and our imposing sanctions, which caused the tribes to reemerge. The tribes are reemerging again now in Afghanistan. I mean, not that they ever went away. It's always been a very poor country.
Well, all of these things are pretty complicated, and there's just so many interfaces between them. I take and go back and listen to the, you know, go back on White Rose and pull up these articles, these discussions you have, and repeat them or listen to them over and over, and recommend them to my friends also. What was the reference you also mentioned on this Monday magazine or whatever for the tribe situation that you talked about a little while ago?
Yeah, it's called firstmonday.org is the website. An article by William McAllister, The Iraq Insurgency. Got to run, Gary. Thanks for the call. 27 minutes past the hour.
There's something wrong with the world today. I don't know what it is. Something's wrong with our eyes. We see the things in a different way. God knows it ain't his. It sure ain't no surprise.
And welcome back. 33 minutes past the hour for your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity. Tom Hartman with you. Or is it 34 minutes past? Well, we'll be in 20 seconds. Anyhow, the Guardian, I believe it is. What is it? Yeah, the Guardian, the British newspaper, is claiming that in the State of the Union address, the SOTUS, that George W. Bush is going to initiate an historic shift in global warming. In other words, he's going to change his mind. The White House official officially said, the story is inaccurate on all fronts, and especially regarding the State of the Union. Bush is still in denial. There is no global warming. It is a big debate among scientists who don't seem to know very much about it. And besides that, as James Inhofe, the Republican who is chairman of the Senate committee that oversaw things like global warming, God's going to take care of it. So George W. Bush is apparently not concerned about that. However, the National Association of Evangelicals, the trade association for 45,000 churches, has come out and said this. Their spokesman Rich Sizek said, whether God created the earth in a millisecond or whether it evolved over billions of years, the issue we agree on is that it needs to be cared for today. And they are joining with scientists around the world, 45,000 churches, the National Association of Evangelicals, to fight global warming. This is, in their opinion, a moral and religious issue as much as anything else. And speaking of moral and issue and religious issues, today, the day we celebrate the birth of Dr. Martin Luther King, a little more of his talk on the 4th of April, 1967, a year to the day before he was assassinated, about the title of the talk was Beyond Vietnam, about really the nature of the future of America.
A true revolution of values will soon look uneasily on the glaring contrast of poverty and wealth with righteous indignation It will look across the seas and see individual capitalists of the West investing huge sums of money in Asia, Africa, and South America, only to take the profits out with no concern for the social betterment of the countries and say this is not just.
In fact, I'd say now it's gone even beyond that. We're actually supporting communist dictatorships as long as they'll have their people ship us, you know, work for cheap and send us cheap goods. We're supporting communist China that if you need a kidney, they'll take they'll find your blood type, take a prisoner out and shoot him if you need the kidney. I mean, Dr. King, I don't think he ever even imagined how bad it would get.
It will look at our alliance with the landed gentry of South America and say, this is not just.
That would be Vicente Fox and, you know, his heir now, the conservatives.
The Western arrogance of feeling that it has everything to teach others and nothing to learn from them is not just.
Case in point, Iraq.
A true revolution of values will lay hand on the world order and say of war, this way of settling differences is not just.
Case in point, what Bush is planning for Iran. It was not missed by most commentators that in his speech, what, four nights ago, whenever it was, George W. Bush, even though he mentioned Syria and Iran, never once mentioned diplomacy. Only mentioned war.
This business of burning human beings with napalm,
which we have used now in Iraq,
of filling our nation's homes with orphans and widows, of injecting poisonous drugs of hate into the veins of peoples normally humane, of sending men home from dark and bloody battlefields physically handicapped and psychologically deranged, cannot be reconciled with wisdom, justice, and love. A nation that continues year after year to spend more money on military defense than on programs of social uplift is approaching spiritual death.
And that's probably one of the most important points in my opinion. I suspect in Dr. King's opinion as well, one of the most important points that he made was that a nation that spends more money on instruments of war than it does on social needs is approaching spiritual death. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Joe in Eugene, Oregon. Hey, Joe, what's on your mind today?
Hi. You've had a great program this morning, a lot of inspirational words. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
In the spirit of Dr. King and his inspirational figure, Gandhi, we're all looking for ways to make our individual voices heard. Right now, I think, is on the question of whether this war will continue, where it seemed to be at a very pivotal point where it's teetering in the balance. It will either continue or we will start to pull back. And if people, there's a lot of us, all the polls say there's really a lot of us in the States right now who feel that we should definitely bring this to a close. And if, as Dr. King said, maybe it's time for us all to stand up. And one way that we have, the greatest power we have is the power of the purse. I mean, Congress has power of the purse, but that money comes from us. And it's tax time coming up. If politely worded IOU were to, thousands of them, maybe hundreds of thousands were to come to the government promising to pay our tax burden, when it became clear to us that money was not going to be used for further escalation in Iraq, maybe that would help. I'll do it if somebody else will do it anyway.
Yeah. If we were just to point out that the average American family has already spent about $3,200 on this war in Iraq, you know, I mean, there have to be ways to boil this down and make it absolutely understandable. Good point, Joe. Thank you very much. John in Gilbert, Arizona. Hey, John.
Hey, Tom. I refer to you as my teacher.
Well, thank you.
Hey, Tom, I got two questions for you, Tom.
Yes, sir.
I was wondering, what is the purpose of law enforcement with this criminal president, since he thinks he's above the law? And my second question to you is, when is Criminal Bush going to realize that our military men and women are not disposable?
Yeah, well, in answer to your first question, you know, it's a rhetorical question, so I don't all I can give you is a rhetorical answer, I suppose, and that probably wouldn't serve much good. The actually, in response to your first question, you know, if Bush doesn't recognize the law, I think, frankly, there are people in Congress who do recognize the law, and hopefully there are still a few judges who recognize the law, and he will be held to account for some of these things.
I hope so.
Yeah. With regard to your second point, I'm sorry,
My second question was, when is he going to realize that our military men and women are not
right.
Negotiable?
Yeah, well, this comes back to this fundamental, I hesitate to use the word pathology or psychopathology, but I don't frankly know a better one, that we see in George W. Bush, and that is, you know, without trying to psychoanalyze the guy or get into too much psychobabble, I mean, there is a particular type of human being who views other people not as humans but as objects to be used. And these kinds of people are typically called sociopaths. They're very charming. They tend to be very charming. They sometimes can actually be very successful. Ted Bundy, for example, everybody thought he was a marvelous guy. Some of them are able to, you know, Jim Jones amass a number of followers and all that kind of thing. And yet they don't they lack this just fundamental quality of understanding that there's anybody in the world other than themselves who is human. They think that they're the only individual in the world who is totally human, who is actually capable of feeling. Or they're so disconnected from their feelings that they assume everybody else is too.
Right.
And you know, George Bush revealed that to me in the Carla Faye Tucker thing. When he sat down with that Time magazine reporter and then later with Tucker Carlson, and Tucker Carlson tells this story and made
right.
a joke about Carla Faye Tucker, who had undergone this conversion to Christianity and was begging him for mercy, for life in prison. She murdered her husband. And then he makes a joke about her. He rubs his hands together and giggling in this kind of girlish voice goes, and she says, "Save me, Governor Bush, please save me." even Tucker Carlson was creeped out by that.
Right.
And when I hear that story and I hear that, you know, he bragged about the fact that he never spent more than 20 minutes examining the details of any of the people that he executed, and he bragged about the fact that he executed more people than any governor in history. I'm frankly very concerned about the man's mental health. And so your question, when is he going to discover or realize that our soldiers are not disposable? I don't think he ever will. I think it's going to take Congress to hold him to account, John.
And Tom, hey, Tom?
Yeah.
Hey, and another thing, too, I was wondering is, I mean, isn't there some kind of legality where, you know, when men and women decide to join the armed forces, they're here to protect our nation, we the people, not for somebody who's war-hungry for legal wars. I mean, isn't there any kind of fine line there going on?
Well, there probably is, John, and I'm not the expert on it, but I can tell you that George Bush, and the military for that matter, swear to protect the Constitution, not the people, and that's clearly under assault. Time now for our progressive pop quiz, our question for the day. On this holiday, we celebrate the life of whom? The sixth caller with the correct answer at 866-440-THOM gets a copy of Screwed, my new book.
Everybody's got to pay. Some people got to pay more. Well, you can tell the people anything. Spoonfeed them anything you like. It used to be so simple. It used to be my life.
And welcome back. Talking back to the mainstream media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Tom Hartman here with you. And we have a winner in our progressive pop quiz. Once again, our question on this holiday today, we celebrate the life of whom? And congratulations to Robert Bakary of McDonald, Pennsylvania. Robert knew the correct answer is, of course, the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. And congratulations, Robert. He wins a copy, autographed and personalized by me, of my new book, Screwed, The Undeclared War Against the Middle Class and What We Can Do About It. Martin Luther King's comment, this is just so, so important.
A nation that continues year after year to spend more money on military defense than on programs of social uplift is approaching spiritual death.
And this has been basically the position ever since Ronald Reagan became president, is Star Wars. It's amping up and spending mind-boggling amounts of money on the military. But Martin Luther King said, no, peace has to be the priority.
America, the richest and most powerful nation in the world, can well lead the way in this revolution of values. That is nothing except a tragic death wish to prevent us from reordering our priorities so that the pursuit of peace will take precedence over the pursuit of war.
So that the pursuit of peace will take precedence over the pursuit of war. And then, of course, George W. Bush asked, hey, if you decide that you want to amp up your war, don't the Democrats have some say in this?
If you have the authority to put the troops in there no matter what the Congress wants to do.
I think I've got, in this situation, I do, yeah. Now, I fully understand they could try to stop me from doing it. But I've made my decision, and we're going forward.
Yeah. And Condi Rice, this was actually from a little earlier, but it's worth revisiting. Chuck Hagel interrogating Condi Rice last week.
My question was the escalation of American troops in Iraq.
I think you asked who was supporting it, and I said the Kurdish parties, Prime Minister Maliki and his Shia allies, and the IIP support a plan to do this, and they know that the augmentation of American forces is part of that plan.
Augmentation? What, are we talking about cosmetic surgery here?
Now, as to the question of escalation, I think that I don't see it, and the president doesn't see it as an escalation. What he sees
20,
is
22,000 new troops, more troops in, is not an escalation?
Well, I think, Senator, escalation is not just a matter of how many numbers you put in. Escalation is also a question of, are you changing the strategic goal of what you're trying to do? Are you escalating?
Would you call it a decrease and billions of dollars
I would call it, Senator, an augmentation that allows the Iraqis to deal with this very serious problem that they have in Baghdad.
It's an augmentation. Now, if you look in the military manual, you will not find the word augmentation. The only place you find the word augmentation in anything that has to do with the military is in the medical manuals where they talk about breast implants. I don't know what Condi's been reading, but anyhow, 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number, Jake in Arcata, California. Hey, Jake, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom, how's it going?
Just great. What's up?
I don't think we can, you know, expect any more from a Secretary of State who was spending thousands of dollars on shoes while people were drowning in New Orleans. So, you know, Condoleezza Rice, you know, doesn't have much credibility to begin with.
Point taken.
And speaking of people who have no credibility, Dick Cheney. I know Scooter Libby's going on trial this week. Dick Cheney's going to have to testify. And with Henry Waxman and his investigation into Halliburton and the no-bid contracts, I think Dick Cheney's days are numbered as vice president.
He's going to, I guarantee you, he is going to say, we have executive privilege, I don't have to testify. And they're going to spend the next 2 years fighting over whether or not he has to testify. And if it looks like it's going to get really close, if it looks like it's going to get really dangerous, I predict Joe Lieberman is going to switch parties.
Well, you know, if Joe Lieberman does that, he'll forever be known as Traitor Joe.
Well, I think he's already there. I don't think he cares.
Yeah, you're right, Tom.
I don't think he cares. I think he has, you know, he has surrendered. You know, it's somebody came up to him and said,
"You don't know the power of the dark side."
And he said, "Oh, very interesting." and off he went. Anyhow, Jake, thanks for the call. Yeah, we'll see how this shakes out. This is interesting. Number 12 in Santa Fe, New Mexico, listening on KTRC. Hey, number 12, how you doing?
You know, Tom, the problem with being on hold with you is the topics change so much I completely lose track of what I wanted to say.
Okay, is there something new you want to say? We have about a half a minute.
Basically, I don't think you're going to cure the problem by throwing more liberal Democratism, because it's just the other side of the coin. It's just the bad cop or the good cop or whatever. I'm pro-Constitution, pro-Bill of Rights, and both parties are in favor of things like the IRS. And when I hear the Democrats say something like, we need more taxation, that means we need to have more of a dividend paid to these private shareholders.
You know, I haven't heard any Democrats say we need more taxation. I have heard Democrats suggest, and Republicans as well, that it would be nice to balance the budget. But, I mean, how are you going to pay for those roads that you like to use, number 12, if you don't tax yourself?
Here's the deal. you're not going to balance the budget because the Federal Reserve system is corrupt. It will never be balanced because what we call inflation is the dividend payment paid to the private bankers that are behind the facade of the Federal Reserve system.
Yeah, well, I can't entirely argue against that because I agree that the Fed is not quite what it should be, shall we say. But I don't think that that's the fundamental problem. I mean, you know, when Reagan came into power, we had a debt of around $1 trillion. Now we have a debt of $8 trillion. This is all about starve the beast. This is about drive the debt up to the point where there can be no social spending. Because the conservatives think, oh, social spending, that's a transfer of wealth. That's socialism. We can't have that. Terrible thing. And so they're going to try and get around the back door. We'll be back right after this, 56 minutes past.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
Yes. Is it the Texas strategy that George W. is pursuing? Paul Krugman asking the question. In the, presumably in the New York Times, hundreds of articles and opinion pieces have described President Bush's decision to escalate the Iraq war as a Hail Mary pass. But that's the wrong metaphor, says Dr. Krugman. He says Bush isn't Roger Staubach. He's not trying to pull out a win for the Dallas Cowboys. He's Charles Keating, using other people's money to keep Lincoln Savings going long after it should have been shut down, and squandering the life savings of thousands of investors, not to mention billions in taxpayer dollars. You'll recall Charles Keating, the heavy Republican donor, good friend of Neil Bush. Neil Bush, of course, with the Silverado Savings Bank going down that same road. We ended up having to spend $500 billion, $500 billion, roughly the cost of the war in Iraq so far, to bail out these scam artists, including George W. Bush's brother, in the savings and loan scandal, which had become basically a Ponzi scheme. They were showing all these phony profits and using them to justify huge salaries for themselves. And then when it became impossible to hide any longer, they said, somebody's got to help us out. And Bush Sr., as I recall, maybe it was Clinton. I'm not sure who was president exactly when that all went down, the Keating thing. I thought it was Bush Sr. Comes riding to the rescue and says, okay, no problem. We'll take care of you. Here's some taxpayer money. This is not a Hail Mary pass. This is all about the decent interval. Rosa Brooks wrote a great piece in the Los Angeles Times on Friday. She said, by 1971, Nixon and Kissinger understood that winning in Vietnam was no longer in the cards. So instead of talking about winning the war, they started talking about winning the next election. As Nixon put it in March of 1971, we can't have the South Vietnamese knocked over brutally. And then Kissinger finished the thought before the election. So Nixon and Kissinger pushed the South Vietnamese to, quote, stand on their own, end quote. Does this sound familiar? At the same time, through China, Kissinger's telling the North Vietnamese, we're going to let you win. Just not right away. Rosa Brooks notes, as historian Jeffrey Kimball has documented, Kissinger's talking points for his first meeting with Chinese Premier Zhou Enlai on the topic of Vietnam included a promise that the U.S. would withdraw all troops and leave the political evolution of Vietnam to the Vietnamese. These are quotes from Kissinger. The U.S. would, quote, let objective realities, end quote, North Vietnamese military superiority, quote, shape the political future, end quote. In the margins of his briefing book, Kissinger scrawled a handwritten elaboration for Cho, for Joe. We want a decent interval. You have our assurance. As she notes, this is the election of 72. That I mentioned earlier, the election of 74. But excuse the mistake. Oh, wait a minute. It must have been, 72. The decent interval strategy worked by declaring that peace was at hand. This was the quote that Kissinger used. He took the wind out of anti-war Democrat George McGovern's sails, and Nixon won re-election. In 74, in December of 74, the South Vietnamese government was clearly disintegrating. There was no way this war could be won. We were learning the lesson that the French learned, frankly. No country wants to be occupied by a foreign country, particularly one that represents an entirely alien culture. And so Congress, Nixon basically got Congress to pull the plug, a Democratic Congress. The following April, Saigon fell, just as Nixon and Kissinger had privately predicted 2 years earlier, but enough time had elapsed for Republicans to pin the blame on South Vietnamese missteps and, most importantly, on the perfidy of the Democratic Party. They created the myth of the Democratic Party as weak and anti-military and helped keep the White House in Republican hands for all but 12 of the last 30 years. It's all about the decent interval. You get it? That's what this is about. It's the Texas strategy. The Ponzi scheme. Good old Mr. Ponzi, I believe his first name was Albert Ponzi, on Pie Alley in Boston, set up shop, as I recall it was in the 1920s. And he said that because of World War I and the devaluation of European currencies, he could buy up stamps, coupons, mostly stamps. He could buy up stamps with devalued currency and redeem them with real currency. Now, it doesn't make any sense, but that's what he said. And so, a few people gave him a couple of $1,000, and he paid new investors with the money from the original investors, and people were making, in 2 weeks, they were making 40, 50% profit. And word spread, and at one point in Pie Alley, Ponzi had half a dozen people who were doing nothing but taking cash in continuously. I mean, it was incredible. Just paying off people with the revenue from the new investors. Until the word spread that there were no stamps, that it was a phony thing. It was actually an article in one of the Boston newspapers. Exposed it. And everybody showed up and said, I want my money back. And he obviously didn't have enough money to give it back, and the whole thing collapsed. Thus, Ponzi scheme. It's what Nixon did in Vietnam. It's what Bush is doing now. It's what Keaton and Neil Bush did with the savings and loan scandal. It's all over again. And in my opinion, the new investors that Bush is going to bring in to pay off the old investors, the way he's going to keep this thing going, as long as he's in office, which, barring impeachment, will be another 735 days, 9 hours, 43 minutes, and 40 seconds, is by starting a war with Iran and Syria. We're going to start hearing, mark my words, we're going to start hearing about Hezbollah. Hezbollah is a client. They received some support from Iran. Israel thought they could take them out of southern Lebanon. They didn't. They got their butts kicked. We're going to start hearing that Hezbollah is infiltrating Iraq and that Iran is their primary patron. Nobody ever talks about Al-Qaeda being a bunch of Saudis, by the way. Isn't that odd? But nonetheless, that's what you're going to hear. And the doubling down is going to be leading right into Iran, in my opinion. Jim in Lansing, Michigan. Hey, Jim, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom. Yeah, I was around those years. I was around during the savings and loan scandal years, and I kept saying, boy, if they don't put some of these perpetrators in jail, they're going to come back and scam us again, and guess what?
Yeah, here we are.
anyway, yeah,
they nailed Keating, but he was just the sacrificial lamb.
Yeah. I called about the call for the March on Washington on the 27th. That's a week from this Saturday.
Yes.
I kind of want to take my fellow liberals to task a bit here. There's this kind of cutesy definition going around Air America has for years about the definition of insanity. You do the same thing, and you expect different results. And I would submit that that's what we liberals are doing. Now, you're talking to someone who spent hundreds of hours going door-to-door, lit drops, phone banking, you know, calling reps and senators, and people call into your show every day and say, what can I do, what can I do? But I would submit that the things we're doing are the easy things. And I remember back in the Vietnam days, what really put that war out of business, well, a couple things did, but one was hundreds of thousands of us, boots on the ground in Washington, D.C., over and over.
Yeah.
And at some point, we liberals, your listeners, are going to have to ask ourselves, what sacrifice are we willing to make? Now,
well,
I'm going to be driving from Michigan to D.C.
Yep. And I'm flying there, and I'm flying there from Oregon, so.
Yeah, and, you know, and I'm not rich. It's an expense, and I've been there before for other protests, but at some point,
Jim, we have to take a break here. We have to wrap it up. But the bottom line point is that you're calling for people to show up in Washington, D.C. a week from Saturday, right? Hello? Yeah. Okay. Great. I agree with you. And I will continue to promote it. In fact, on Thursday and Friday, I'll be doing the program live from Washington, D.C., and we'll be promoting it like crazy. And we'll be doing it from a radio row there at the Family USA Conference. And Thursday night of that week, and we even have a gig open to the public. So we'll be back with more of your calls right after this, 16 minutes past the hour.
I call on Washington today. I call on every man and woman of goodwill all over America today. I call on the young men of America who must make a choice today. Take a stand on this issue. Tomorrow may be too late. Book may close. And I don't know about you. I ain't gonna study war no more.
And welcome back to the place where smart people get their news. The Tom Hartman Program. Gene in Windsor, California. You are on the air. Hey, Gene.
Oh, hi. I really enjoyed all this. Martin Luther King recordings you're playing. Thank you so much for that.
You're welcome.
And
thank him for his life. I mean, that's what we need to be doing on this day is remembering what an extraordinary life, an extraordinary man.
Well, it's very rare to hear about him. I mean, get this day off, and I don't understand why we don't hear more of the words he spoke. So I thank you. And I want to thank you for talking about the Ponzi scheme, too, because when I see these guys, Bush, every time he comes up with one of these pauses that we're all supposed to wait to hear what he says, all I can think of is that he's buying time to allow the scam to morph into something new or, you know, to divest from it and do something else. It's just, anyway, I called because the McAllister article on the tribal societies that you were talking about, that was so interesting. But it reminds me that I wanted to add that there's that concept of tribal justice is applied beyond tribal systems. I've heard about it existing throughout the East as saving face.
Yes.
Or they call it face saving the dictionary, preserving prestige.
Yeah.
And
that's a way of actually, it's another way of saying equilibrium.
Uh-huh.
Because if you can save face and I can save face, then we're in relative balance to each other. If one of us loses face, then there is imbalance. And when there's imbalance, then action is required to restore balance.
Uh-huh. And they apply it to family and social groups and the individual as well.
Yeah.
And my theory about it is that it's like they're extracting justice in the absence of dependable legal systems.
That's exactly
where
what it
fair
is.
Justice is based on firm human rights. And when they don't have that, this is a substitute. Well, now we look on it like it's revenge and vendetta, but I think it's their attempt, what you're, like you're saying, for equilibrium and to finding justice where a justice system doesn't exist to cover grievances.
Yes, and they use the words of revenge and vendetta, but they don't have the negative connotation that they do in our society.
Ah.
They have, they, you know, they have the connotation of what is necessary to restore balance. There's a lot been written about this in the literature of sociology. One of the best books, in my opinion, I used it rather heavily as a source when I was writing Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight, was Peter Farb's book, Man's Rise to Civilization and the Native American. Peter Farb died in the 70s or 80s. His book first came out in 64, I think, and it's out of print now, but you can buy used copies over at abebooks.com for, you know, $1.50. And it is the best ethnography, the best overview of the pre-contact and first contact Native American tribes across the United States. And he has, you know, individual chapters devoted to different tribes and tribal areas and gets into all the details of the various tribes. All of the research in my book Last Hours about the Shoshone I got from Peter Farb, and I acknowledge him for it. Dan Quinn quotes him at some length in one of his Ishmael books about the tribe down in what is now the New Orleans area that had a caste system, one of the few actual caste systems that they found, a highly rigid four-caste social structure. But in order to maintain social mobility, if you were in the highest caste, your oldest child had to marry somebody in the lowest caste. If you were in the second caste, your first child had to marry somebody in the third caste. If you were so what happened was every family had within their extended family members of all four castes, and every family and the patriarch of every family every four generations was in one of the four different castes. And so it was a highly fluid system, even though there was this rigid caste structure to it. And the lowest caste were referred to as the Stinkards, which I always thought was kind of interesting. And the highest caste were the sun gods. And as I said, Dan Quinn talks about that. But that all came from Peter Farb. And he points out that whole concept of face was really all about maintaining balance in society, maintaining
right,
stability.
Right, and all these cultures have so much to offer. And when you have something like the Bush world, it's like this Pax Americana, and it has nothing to do with finding and making a wonderful understanding of all these things. And
yeah. Bush's worldview is essentially Victorian or pre-Victorian feudal, F-E-U-D-A-L worldview. That is, you know, kings and lords and ladies in waiting and servants and serfs. And that's how Bush, you know, he views himself as the heir to a dynasty. And he is. I mean, he was born with hundreds of millions of dollars in a trust fund or millions of dollars and certainly access to hundreds of millions through his family and, you know, on a huge estate in Connecticut. He grew up wealthy. He went to the very best prep schools. He went to the very best colleges. He was given every opportunity, and he views himself as royalty. Gene, I got to run along. Got to take a break here. Thanks for the call, though, and thanks for listening to us on The Quake. We're going to talk with Daryl Anderson, an Iraq war veteran and peace activist who became a war resister after going AWOL in January 2005. He has an extraordinary story to tell, and then back to your calls. 27 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. He's going to be back in charge.
Remember back in a month, they found the money was gone. So you fled from the country as fast as you could, and you found yourself out here with friends. Richard Byrne and Paul Wolfowitz knew you were ready to swim. So you made up a way of a deal for a hell of a deal.
As this from the Times Online, the London Times, the Times of London, Mr. Shalabi is now poised to gain a top job in the new Shia-led government and conceivably the prime ministership. A vote is expected within 2 or 3 days. Even if Mr. Shalabi fails to win the top job, he is likely to secure a cabinet post. He, of course, is the guy who supplied much of the faulty intelligence, for which we paid him $350,000 a month, you may recall, about Iraq's alleged weapons of mass destruction. He is also the guy who was sentenced in absentia in Jordan to 22 years of hard labor for embezzlement. $347,000 a month. That's how much we were paying this guy. And he's also the guy who persuaded Paul Bremer to do debathification. A good Sunni who destroyed, or a good Shia who destroyed the Sunnis. Daryl Anderson is with us. He's an Iraq war veteran and a peace activist. He became a war resister after going AWOL in January of 2005, was discharged without court-martial 3 months ago. And Daryl, welcome. Welcome to the Tom Hartman program.
Thank you.
Website I have for you, ivawdeployed.org?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. Daryl, tell our listeners why you chose, having been in Iraq, why you chose to go absent without leave in January 2005.
Basically, I was in Baghdad from January to July of 2004. I was there for April of 2004, was the month that we lost the most soldiers in the whole war until last December. And basically, I watched my brothers commit war crimes. And in April, our procedures got more drastic, and the more soldiers died, the more innocent civilians we killed. And basically was just, I believed it was my duty as a soldier to refuse war crimes, and I believed it, I had the human right to choose not to kill innocent civilians. And, I could go into detail with experiences and stuff that happened to me there, if you would like for that.
I am curious what you mean when you say war crimes, yes.
In April, more soldiers had died. All of a sudden, our procedures switched over, and I was told by my superiors, if we're fired upon in an open market, the grocery market, or wherever we're in downtown Baghdad, if we're fired upon, to open fire on everybody there. And I said, well, what about innocent civilians? And they said, if they're there when the crime is being committed, they're no longer innocent. And we followed these procedures. We would get shot at, and everybody would open fire, and you would just see bodies dropping. And, you know, what's happening? We're killing women and children, not because we're monsters, but because we're told to. And this is what happened in April 4. The whole war switched over from, a peacekeeping occupation, if you could even call it that, to we got to stay alive. Let's kill everybody we can because another dead Iraqi is a good Iraqi. Mm-hmm. And this is the mentality we had when we were there.
There was a particular time when one of your commanding officers gave you an order that you refused?
Oh, yeah. We were under fire for a few hours, and I watched one fellow soldier die out there in combat. And the firefight was over, things calmed down, and we were trying to secure our little perimeter, and we set up a traffic stop. And three cars rolled by with Iraqi families trying to escape the horrors of this battle we're having in downtown Baghdad in April. And we turn them away, but this fourth car comes rolling down the street, doesn't stop. It proceeds through our traffic stop and stops in front of my position, and sparks are coming from bad brakes, and all my guys and my superiors are yelling at me, fire, fire, what are you doing, what are you doing? I said, no, don't fire, don't fire. And my superior runs over to me, and he's, what just happened? You were supposed to fire at this car, follow your procedure. And I said, SARS, the window's rolled down at this time, and there's two kids in the back, a mother and father in the front. And I said, you know, I did the right thing. You know, these people, I saved their lives. If you didn't, next time you'll be fired. Next time you'll fire, you'll be punished. And that's the day it hit me that, you know, well, I'm not going to kill these people. I have brown skin. I look more like an Iraqi than these other American boys I'm with. And it really, you know, I didn't see two Muslims or cowheads or whatever things they tell us to call them. I saw my sister. I saw my brother in the back. And that's what really flipped it over for me.
Yeah. So how extensive in your mind are these, what you're describing as war crimes in the military culture there in Iraq?
Oh, yeah, it goes a lot deep. I knew three guys who vividly described to me how they crowded around a prisoner. He had a bag over his head, and he was handcuffed, and three of them, one front and two on the side, they beat him.
And they talked about how the last punch and kick they all did at the same time, and the guy dropped over and died. And they told me they beat this prisoner to death. And they said, like, I just couldn't believe it that these 18-year-old boys who came to do good were talking about how they had beaten a prisoner to death. They asked them, why'd you do it? And they said, well, he's a mortar man. He got a few of our guys. We had to take care of it. And so I can understand the mentality that they're in. And this guy, so to them, wasn't a good person, so they killed him. When he was handcuffed and with a bag over his head, which is obviously against the Geneva Conventions and everything the U.S. military is supposed to stand for.
Yeah.
But the unit, they just got rid of the dead body. There was no investigation, no punishment, no talk about it, because that's what happened and no one was going to say anything.
Have you told the Army about this?
I told the Army, but I won't ever name names because it's not these kids. They were told, I mean, Rumsfeld himself sent orders down to strip these Iraqis of their clothes, stick dogs on them, and make them stand naked in prison cells. Like, this is orders from the top, not just these soldiers like England. They didn't just come up with these procedures to treat prisoners like this. We were ordered to treat prisoners like this. We were ordered to kill innocent civilians. So no soldiers should be tried on war crimes. It's obviously not us. We're just there trying to stay alive.
Yeah, yeah. How are the Iraqi people perceiving the American presence?
Oh, they hate us. You can't talk to one Iraqi who has not lost family members. And during the invasion, we bombed. And I didn't know this when I got there in 04, but I know it now. But I'd met guys that said, you know, I've lost three kids. I've lost my brother. I've lost, you know, my house is blown up. Like, how are they supposed to react when you roll down the street, half the houses are blown up, and you can't meet an Iraqi who hasn't lost a family member by American forces? Saddam didn't kill everybody in Iraq's family member. America did. Like, Iraqis would look me in the eyes and say, you know, I hated Saddam, but oh, how I missed the days of Saddam.
Hmm.
You guys are worse. We were never stopping the civil war that was going there in 04. Every day we'd go out there and clean up the bodies, but we would never roll out and stop the killings. So we weren't stopping the Civil War. We were just adding to the numbers. And that's why the only success we could have in this war is to pull out all together. And it's going to be bad, but there'll be less deaths than there is now.
If we just left right now.
Yeah, just we have away. To. It's the right of the Iraqi people to fight this out themselves. We had civil wars in America. How come they can't have their civil wars? It's their right as their people, their country, to figure it out themselves, not us to enforce democracy at gunpoint. It's not going to work.
Yeah. So I it would be probably safe to assume that you think that George Bush's so-called surge strategy, throwing more soldiers into Baghdad, is just going to result in more dead people and no good outcome.
It's just going to ruin more lives.
Yeah. Yeah. What are you doing now, Daryl Anderson? I have this website, ivawdeployed.org. I'm not familiar with it. What's the work that you're doing now? Are you just traveling around telling your story? I know you were in Portland a while ago, speaking at the Multnomah friend's house.
We rolled in Iraq Veterans Against the War bus from Georgia to Seattle, Washington, and we camped outside Fort Lewis to support Lieutenant Watada and Suzanne Swift through their court marshals and dealing with the military. But what really caught me is when we were out there and soldiers were coming by and we were power fisting them and we were saluting and giving peace signs to soldiers, that they were returning them. Mm-hmm. And we were counting that like 100 soldiers a day would roll by and give us a power fist. Carloads. We had soldiers that would drive by in their civilian uniforms, roll their window down, pump a power fist, and just start screaming at the top of their lungs, and then speed off in their car. These soldiers are done. They're not going back for that third tour. They're not going to let... I mean, like, as in me, I'm more upset with anti-war movements and liberals and Republicans, because they're just as much to blame as because in 04, my buddies were dying in Iraq. In 05, I was sitting AWOL in Canada alone. 06, I was in Canada. 06, I came to face the military and got released. And I'm going through all this pain, all this struggle to fight to end this war, and these protesters are out there with their iPods taking pictures smiling.
Yeah.
People understand that soldiers were given up our lives to stop this war. Ouattara is facing 6 years in prison, and people don't care. They don't have the anger. They don't have the frustration. We're still trying to do this peacefully. And these marches.
Daryl, stick around for a minute, okay?
Okay.
We have to take a break. I'm sorry.
All right.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Dwight Eisenhower, the old five-star general and warrior, said,
every gun that is made, every warship launched, every rocket fired signifies, in the final sense, a theft from those who hunger and are not fed, those who are cold and are not clothed.
Signifies a theft. And Martin Luther King, whose birthday we celebrate this day.
A nation that continues year after year to spend more money on military defense than on programs of social uplift is approaching spiritual death.
And we're speaking with Daryl Anderson, a man who has seen firsthand both the wisdom of Eisenhower and Martin Luther King. IVAWdeployed.org, the Vietnam Veterans Against the War, is that IVAW?
Iraq Veterans Against the War.
Iraq Veterans Against the War. Yeah, thank you. Deployed.org. Daryl, you were saying that you're more angry with liberals who show up at protests with iPods than with Republicans who voted to send you to Iraq. There's a fundamental disconnect for me there. I don't get it.
Yeah, well, it's just I'm traveling across the country, and every place I go to, they have these anti-war organizations. And each organization has hired civilians to work for them. And I'm on a bus. I'm a homeless combat veteran who gave up everything to resist this war. And I'm asking them, how come you're not giving me a job? You know, how come you guys aren't supporting? I ask people, do you guys know who Ivan Brobeck is? Do you guys know who Ricky Clausen and Mark Wilkerson is? They say no. I say these guys are resistors. They're combat veterans who refuse their second employment. If you guys are anti-war, how come you don't know who resistors are? How come you don't know who Daryl Anderson is? You know, what are you guys doing with this movement when you got these guys who've given up their lives and you're not even helping them? You're not there. You know, like, what is the goal of this anti-war movement? Is it to put paychecks in activists' pockets, or is it to help soldiers resist this war? Because Democrats aren't going to end the war. The people, the protests aren't going to end the war. It's the soldiers. When the soldiers say no, that's when the war will stop. And I go to these protests, and there's more soldiers out there protesting the war than civilians. Where are the people? Why are they leaving it up to us? And I ask people, you know, I'm $10,000 in debt. I've lost my GI Bill. I've lost my health care. I'm suffering from PTSD every day from the stuff I did in Iraq. And what have you sacrificed? What have you given up? And they say nothing. And after I speak, they come and they tell me all their conspiracy theories. And I say, no, don't come tell me what you think. Come tell me what you did. Tell me you stood out in the rain every weekend for a year straight with a sign protesting the war. Tell me you stood outside the base and power fisted soldiers. Don't tell me how you feel, because I don't care no more. Every day, I have a 19-year-old cousin in Iraq right now, and every day she's going through the same thing I went through while these protesters are out there getting their paychecks off our pain. And it's killing me.
You. First of all, you think protesters are paid to protest?
No, but organizations have paid organizers.
Occasionally. I can tell you, this is not a high-paid industry.
Every organization has a few paid civilians.
Sure.
I mean, protesters aren't paid.
Yeah.
But all they're doing is standing together in a place like in the big 27th protest.
None Isn't it better than nothing? Daryl, I mean, wouldn't you rather have them out there protesting than you know, watching the football game and eating Cheetos?
Oh, yeah. No. The movement is helping, but they're just putting their force in the wrong direction. They're still talking about 3,000 dead. They're still talking about the mourning and the weeping mothers and this. No. Talk about these guys who are refusing to go. How come we're not, how come when I go to an event, I'm at the end of the line to speak about the war, when none of these activists have been to Iraq? How come when we go to Northridge, we had 10 combat veterans all been to Iraq, and Cindy Sheehan couldn't make it to an event, so they canceled it. And we said, oh, let us take the event, let us take it over. And they said, they told us no. Anti-war activists told us that 10 combat veterans couldn't talk to people about the war.
Well, maybe it wasn't so much that, Daryl, as that they knew that the way that the media works in the United States is there is this bizarre star culture. And if Cindy Sheehan shows up, then people will, then they'll publicize it, and that will cause people to show up. And if she doesn't show up, the news media won't publicize it. And you guys might be, the 10 of you might be standing there with 3 people listening to you.
You're telling me the media won't listen to a combat veteran talk about Iraq?
Well, I think that's what you're telling me.
Exactly. That's the problem with this country. They won't listen to us.
Yeah, so what do we do?
The anti-war movement has to listen to us. They listen to us, then the people listen to us. I've been on CNN 3 times. I've been in Time magazine. I've been on NBC, Good Morning America. You know what I'm saying? The media talks to me all the time. It's just the people don't watch that media. You know, like, I don't know, like, this is, I went to Canada in 2005, and I wasn't anti-war. I saw war crimes, I went to talk about them. And when I got to Canada and I told about these war crimes, people in my hometown of Kentucky, they called me a traitor. They called me a coward. They had a petition to have me publicly hanged. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Like, has any of these people been through that? Have any of these people, I signed Canada.
But just because somebody else hasn't experienced your level of suffering doesn't mean they can't work to try and help you and to help stop the war, Daryl.
The thing, they're not helping me.
Yeah. Well, I get that. IVAW, we're out of time. Sorry, the show is over. But IVAWdeployed.org is the website. Daryl Anderson, can people reach you through that website?
What's that?
Daryl, can people reach you through the website,
yeah,
IVAWdeployed.org? Great.
Yep.
Thank you so much for being with us on the program today.
All right. Thank you.
Good talking with you. Well, it's difficult talking, this whole thing. What kind of a hell has George Bush unleashed? We'll see you tomorrow. And don't forget.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.
That activism begins with you. Get active.
Real words from real people.